This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have done pretty incredible things for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. So often, we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's program is going to be a little different. Each one of the hundreds of veterans I've interviewed over the years has left me feeling privileged for that opportunity. But every once in a while, we hear from a veteran whose name or voice might be familiar. On April 5th, Lon Simmons passed away at the age of 91. If you grew up in California, especially the Bay Area, you definitely heard his voice a time or two, and his legacy stretched well beyond the Giants and 49ers and A's. He is in the Broadcasters Wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. He spent much of his later years on his beloved Maui, and as we're going to hear, he traveled the world with the Coast Guard during World War II. Lon had a booming voice, the quickest of wits, a self-deprecating style, and that wasn't all an act. He really was a humble man, and he was gracious enough to come on Hometown Heroes with me in February of 2012. And I thought, as a tribute to Lon and his legacy, that we could revisit some of that conversation this week, a discussion that started with one of his most fondly remembered play-by-play calls, one of the most improbable and electrifying plays in NFL history.
Back to throw. In trouble. He's going to be sacked. No, gets away. He runs. Gets away again. Goes to the 40. Gets away again. To the 35. Cuts back at the 30. To the 20. The 15. The 10. He dives. Touchdown, 49ers. Young is exhausted. He stumbled as he got to the 2. He could barely move. He dived into the end zone. And the 49ers have taken the lead with 158, a 49-yard touchdown run by Steve Young.
I remember it like it was yesterday. I was riding my bike to an evening church service in my hometown of Los Banos and almost ran into oncoming traffic because of that incredible call and that incredible moment. Lon Simmons, the guy behind that call. Lon, do you get tired of hearing people play back all your calls from all the years of sports announcing?
No, not really. I don't hear them all when they get played back, but what we used to do when I was first with the Giants and the 49ers, all we used to record, tape everything, and then if a player made a great play, we would single that out, put it together, and give it to them as a tape that they kept. And a lot of the ball players from the past came back to me and say, oh, yeah, I've still got that tape, and I listen to it every once in a while. When I'm feeling low, I listen to it, and I feel good about what I did then. It's a good thing to for the players especially to remember or look back and see how what they did at that time was recognized over the air. But with me and Steve Young, it turned out, I told Steve later when I talked to him, I said, you know, we both ran out of gas at about the same time.
But you both put points on the board, and I think that call, as someone who tries to do what you did for so many years for a living, I think what you really did was you captured the sheer incredulity of that call. No one saw that play coming, and it really was remarkable that he was able to do what he did. And I think you could hear that in your voice, that you were as surprised as anyone else.
Well, I was, because it looked definitely like he was going to be sacked. He was surrounded, and he got out. The only thing that I missed, and I regretted that I missed, was a comeback block by Randy Cross in the middle of that run that helped save the day, too, because he certainly should have been credited as, at least partially as much as Steve was.
Well, you've given him the credit now, so that's taken care of. And long before legions of fans were listening to you on the airwaves, the radio was instrumental in spreading the news of the attack that drew America into World War II. You grew up in Southern California. Do you remember where you were on December 7th, 1941, and how you found out the Japanese had attacked?
I remember December 7th because Bill Thompson and I and some of my other pals had gone to the beach on that day. And we came back, and there were newspapers out with the headlines about the Pearl Harbor attack. So that was the first time that I was aware of that. Well, naturally, from that point on, things changed a great deal, but I wasn't able to get into the service until the end of 1942. We went to Glendale College because it was the spring, and we thought, well, let's go to Glendale and play baseball. Mm-hmm. So the three of us went, and there were about five or six other guys, and it turned out to be that we had about 12 that made up a team at Glendale College. We won the Southern California Championship there and lost only one game. And that one game, I lost. We had two pitchers, me and a fellow by the name of Jim Smith. I pitched against the Los Angeles team in the second game. We beat them in the first game earlier in the year, and then in the second game, I lost in 13 innings. Bill and Dick and I worked for the Bank of America, and we worked at the clearinghouse. And what would happen, we had to go in at night and work. So we'd go to school in the morning and daytime, practice baseball or play baseball games in the afternoon, and then go in and go to work. Well, the night before we played L.A. City College in this game that I lost, we worked all night long. We didn't get off work till 6 in the morning. And so we came back to Bill's house and then went over to play the game. And naturally, it had to go 13 innings. And in the 13th inning, they scored a couple of runs against me, and we lost 3-1. That was that situation. At the end of the year at Glendale, Rod Dedeaux, the USC coach, see, I grew up an avid USC fan. From the time I was about 4 years old, I remember listening to their game. Anyway, at the end of our baseball season, Rod Dedeaux offered Ken McBride, our catcher, and me a scholarship to USC. And you talk about it's something that lights up your eyes. But already we, Bill and Dick and I had decided to go in the service. So I didn't take it, but Ken McBride did. So flash ahead to 1944 when I was on the LST. We had received mail. We picked up mail various places. I can't even remember how we got it. But we got this mail, and in it was a Life magazine. And the Life magazine said the life of a V-12 or whatever they called them, student. And it showed Ken McBride, and he was sitting at a table, and there were about 10 USC co-eds lined up around him. And I said, my God, how did I make this bad a mistake? But that was funny that he was there. But going still farther ahead, when I was doing Fresno State sports, we came to play University of Hawaii, and I met Ken at the airport, and he was still in the Marines because after you finished your college, you had to go into the service. He was a captain in the Marines, and I said, well, this is the only time I'm not jealous of you.
Well, I don't blame you back in the time to open up a magazine and see that and wonder what could have been. What was the Coast Guard like for you? And you went in with a couple of buddies, but were you able to stick with those buddies throughout your time in the Coast Guard?
No. We all signed up together, and we were all sent in different directions. And at that time, the military tried to keep good friends and relatives separated. They didn't want you to be in situations, if they were dire situations, where either that many people from a family would be killed or injured in the same action, or they didn't want that to affect how you reacted in those situations. So we were separated. And the funny part was how we joined the Coast Guard was unbelievable. I don't know how we did it, because we were all thinking about first getting in the Naval Air Force, and that didn't work out. And then we were, I don't know what we were thinking. And then we saw this sign that said, not Uncle Sam wants you, but the Coast Guard wants you. And it showed this PT boat and everything. So we thought, well, heck, let's try that. So we went down there, and they were more than happy to take us in. But we still had to wait after we were after we signed up before we were called into service. And it was several months, and so we continued working at the shipyards during that time.
Was there any part of that where you thought, you know, I really want to play baseball, and going into the service is going to interrupt my baseball career?
No, I didn't think about that then. I didn't give it one thought. I knew that I was going into the service. I felt I wanted to go into the service. I felt that's where I should be. And I don't know why I felt that the Coast Guard was the place I was supposed to be, but it turned out that. And naturally, I had to take a lot of flack from people from the Navy and the Marines because of the shield on the arm that what's that for? And they would say, well, that's because they're shallow water sailors. I said, well, some of the shallow water I got into was pretty deep. But anyway, the thing is that I never gave it another thought about baseball. And in the service, I was in for about, I don't know, 3.5 years or more in that service. I never played any baseball. I played catch a couple of times. And on the LST, when we dump off the large landing craft that we had on the front, the deck would be fairly clear. So I had a buddy there, and we had baseball and a big, what do you call them, the big weighted...
Like a medicine ball or something.
Medicine ball, yeah. Okay, well, we had those on there. So I used to play catch with him, but when the ship... I'd be throwing to him, but when the ship would go down, the ball would go right over his head out in the ocean. And so one day I was up on wheel watch, and the officer of the deck said to me, he wasn't a great baseball fan, but he says, the guys had the medicine ball on the deck. And he said, well, he says, at least, he says, you've lost all the baseballs and whatever else we had. I guess we had a football, too, and we lost that. He says, but that's one thing we won't lose. As he said that, the guy threw the medicine ball at another guy, and the ship took a roll, and it hit the deck and rolled into the water. So that was the end of his story right there.
Classic, and I think we all just saw it unfolding in our imaginations. You know, you're pretty good at telling us which way that ball is bouncing. Was that an adjustment for you, civilian life, to the Coast Guard?
The first shock I had was getting on the train in Los Angeles, leaving home for the first time, and going, and I think it took us something like 16 hours to get to Alameda.
Mm-hmm.
Now we get off the train, and it's the middle of the night. We get off the train, and this boat is there, and he says, all right, you guys, line up. And now we go in and get in the barracks, and they issue us some equipment and stuff. And I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? Where's my bed? And so that was sort of an introduction. But then you go through boot camp, and it was pretty strenuous. Not as strenuous, I don't imagine, as the Army or the Marines, but it was certainly a strenuous camp. We had incidents there where you talk about being hazed and stuff, that occurred, that the bosuns were tough guys, and they made you do things that ordinarily you wouldn't want to do or probably shouldn't do.
You wouldn't be the first guy I'd pick on, though.
Well, I didn't know. Are you going to fight back?
I guess not, but you had to be one of the bigger guys.
I spent a great deal of my time in the service getting out of things. I mean, when I went on a ship, I worked myself to death the first few weeks. I volunteered for everything. I did everything. And so I became a guy that they thought, well, here's somebody that really does everything. Then later on, they were appointing guys to do things, and I wouldn't be around. And I wouldn't be called because they weren't worried about me. They knew I was going to be working anyway. The guys used to get on me about that. And I said, well, it's just how you act. You tried to get out of everything right away. I did everything right away and waited to get out of it until they thought I was a really good sailor.
I think there are some life lessons there in that story.
I think one of the things that I think, looking back on my career in the service, that we won the war despite me.
Well, you know, that's, I think, one of the things that has endeared you to so many is you've always been so self-deprecating, and you come up with some great lines that we've heard over the years, and there's another one of them. But I want to hear about some of that action. If you spend 3.5 years in the Coast Guard, I'm sure not every day was the same. Were there ever days and places that you thought, you know what, I wonder what Ken McWright's doing right now, and am I ever going to get back into a situation like that?
You know, honestly, as I look back, probably it seems better than I felt at the time. But one of the things I had in my mind, you talk about baseball, I used to look at the other guys on the ship and feel sorry for them because I knew what I was going to do when I got back.
Mm.
I was going to play professional baseball. That was my idea. I always felt I was going to be a major league pitcher. As it turned out, the only reason I didn't become a major league pitcher was because of the hitters. But I always felt that that's what I was going to do. So I had that idea. And we had, you know, doing all these things that we did, that we had to do, that was GI or whatever we did, but we had fun in between. We had times when we didn't look at being in the service as a bad thing. We looked at it as being in the service, as that's where we were supposed to be. I mean, our country was at war. Where were we supposed to be?
Makes sense to me. That's the familiar voice of Lon Simmons, the legendary sports announcer who died April 5th at the age of 91. It's time for us to take a break, but we'll explore more of Lon's Coast Guard experiences in World War II when we come back. Maybe you'll hear another one of his signature calls along the way, and we're going to discuss that broadcasting career before we're done here as well. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.